The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPont.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. No one is ever really ready for that last big goodbye, even though we know that death is something that everyone faces. However, it's not something that everyone plans for. What are the various approaches to end-of-life care, and how can you decide what is right for you and your loved ones? There's lots of ways for you to join us on this conversation today. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. A lot of people have gone through this, and they have stories to tell and tips to share about how you can make these situations that are difficult a little bit more bearable for everyone. You call in. The number is 210-614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this hour with Dr. Martha Atkins. She is a death educator, professional counselor, executive director of Abode Contemplative Health, a home for the dying, and author of Signpost of Dying. And Dr. Sandra Sanchez-Riley is associate professor of geriatrics and palliative care at UT Health San Antonio. Welcome both for you being here today. So let me start off, death educator, Dr. Martha Atkins, tell me about that title.
So I teach people about death and dying. I am the executive director at Abode Contemplative Care for the Dying, and most conversations I have with people, whether I'm with friends or family or people I meet, we go have dinner, and it always comes back around to the work I do. People are interested in dying. They're interested in what it means for them. They're interested in how people do it. This is a topic that was part of the regular fabric of life 100 years ago. We took care of each other. We helped people die. We helped each other die. We don't do that anymore. And we've lost the nuance of it. And as we have lost that, we've gotten afraid. And so part of my work in the world is to talk about this and help people not be so afraid.
And so you say, well, whenever you go out with people, hey, let's go have coffee, yes, this topic comes up.
Yes, it does. It does for you too, doesn't it?
All the time.
It does.
And so that tells you people are dying to be talking about this.
There you go. Yes.
They really want to talk about
this. They do.
And they're looking, but it's so difficult to get to that point where you can have that conversation.
Sometimes it is. Yeah. We have our own lens of experience that we look through, and maybe we've been with somebody and it hasn't been a pleasant experience, or we didn't find meaning as a pleasant experience, and we're scared about our own experience, and we don't want people to look at us funny, so we don't talk about it. And my invitation is to talk about it.
And Dr. Sandra Sanchez-Riley, is that you've been through that too, huh?
I have, personally and professionally. The majority of my patients are terminally ill, and I also teach medical students, residents, and fellows that actually dying is part of the process and that we are there to support our patients and their families.
It's one of those things where, of course, yeah, we're all going to die. Dying is part of life. We all know these things intellectually. Right. But we don't really think that we have all these things that we do all day long to try and keep this from the being part of getting in front of us. We want to think about other things. We don't want to dwell on it. How do we talk about the end of life in a very positive way and in a healthy way? And even though we have all these impulses not to, how do you first break that subject open, Dr. Sandra Sanchez-Riley?
I will say the first thing is to normalize it. Dying is part of the process. It is like being born. The family should be there. It should be a celebration. And dying eventually will become a celebration of the life, the things you have accomplished. And to normalize the process and telling them everybody is going to go through this, let's talk about it, would be my first step.
And Dr. Martha Atkins, what do you think?
Yeah, I encourage people to find somebody who understands the process that can be kind of a guide. And and with that person begin to have conversations. And I'm thinking about being in a room where somebody is actively dying and the whole family's there and people haven't been there before and we're not sure what to do, and having somebody around who understands the process, who can demystify it and take the scariness away is really helpful. Before that, having conversations over coffee, talking about what kind of end-of-life plans you want to have, talking about who you want to have with you, what kind of music you want to have with you when you're dying. Very simple things that can be really helpful at the end. Those are good conversations to have.
I keep thinking that there are people out there that can't even afford to go to the doctor,
sure.
And they're dealing with issues, the stresses of day-to-day, mm-hmm. and they may think that having these types of conversations is a luxury that they can't afford. Is this something that everyone has access to? Is this just for people who have good health insurance? You know, who has the ability to engage at that level, Dr. Sandra?
Anybody that has access to medical care should be able to have access to these types of conversations.
But not everyone has access to medical
care. I hear you. This is also talked about in churches, in libraries. There are materials in websites and internet. It's all over the place. There are also lectures, for example, at UT Health that talk specifically about that, and those lectures are free. And there are plenty of resources online and stories from different people, if you are a fan of social media, that will inspire you to start the conversation. The point is this doesn't really cost any money. It's more about the wish of having or pursuing these conversations.
And have you found that also, Dr. Martha?
Yeah, there's a great resource that just popped in my head, the Conversation Project, that is free, that you can find on the internet, that's in English and Spanish, and it's sentences and questions that you can ask each other as a family to talk about what you want to have happen for you as you're in an illness, how long you want to continue to pursue medical treatment, do you want to have a feeding tube, do you want to be cared for at home? Do you want to be cared for in a hospital? Those kind of conversations, you got to have somebody brave enough to open the conversation. And
keep it open, because people are going to try and shut it down pretty quick.
Absolutely. Sure. There are some who will, sure.
So how do you counter those measures?
Oh, I just keep talking.
Yep. And use any resource you have. There are movies that can help you. There are songs that can help you. Social media can help you. But most definitely need to be normalized.
So is there like a movie that you think that people should kind of maybe watch together?
There's plenty of movies that I can think of.
What would be a good one?
Let's see. The Bucket List is a pretty fun one. Do you have any other suggestions?
So that's the one where, which is Friedman?
Yes, Morgan Freedman.
Morgan Freedman, they're talking about their end of life desires.
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm. The one I'm thinking of is a Japanese movie that's subtitled, and I can't think of the name of it right now, but it's a really beautiful.
So it's a kind of a way to get everyone in a room together, have a shared experience, kick off conversations, laugh a little bit, and think about, you know, this is what's going to happen, this is where we are, think about where we want to be, and not thinking about it is not going to change where we end up in the end. So we're talking about end-of-life care. We got a couple of experts with us in the studio today, and we'll take your questions and comments, your stories. You can call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back after this quick break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about end-of-life care. Like it or not, this is where we're all going to end up sooner or later, hopefully later for most of us, and all of us. And what are your questions and comments? We've got a couple of experts in the studio ready to take your calls. We want to hear your stories. What have you learned from your experiences that you want others to benefit from? The number is 210-614-8980. Trevor is on the line. And Trevor, hi, welcome to The Source. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing today?
All right.
All right, good, good. Well, I'm actually a family service counselor at a funeral home. And I just wanted to let people know that they can always come in. We work with terminally ill patients, people approaching the end of life, just in general, all the time. And you can really just come in, ask any questions you want. We're very knowledgeable on the subject. We deal with it every day, and we're really there to help. Half the time, I'm just seeing people purely just for information, just telling them, hey, no, these are a couple of things you need to do. Nothing to do with us even, just the fact that we know what's going on. We've been through it. We know how to make the conversation a little bit more comfortable, how to bring it up with your family, and how to really walk you through a lot of the things you have to do. So I want to just really advise people to approach their local funeral home. Don't be afraid to go in there and ask questions and just ask for advice. They deal with it every day, and they're generally really comfortable with it and can help.
Okay. So, Trevor, when people walk in to talk to you about this for the first time, how do they sort of present themselves? And then as they're leaving, how has that changed? Can you see, like, a difference?
Yeah, you can see really when they come in, you know, that first handshake can be a little bit, it can be tense, you know, they're scared, they don't know what they're, you know, I'm in a funeral home, this can be a little bit scary, this is real now, but then within a few minutes, we let them know, it happens to everyone, it's something everybody's going to go through, and really by approaching it now and by handling it, you're just easing that burden on your family a little bit, and you're making things better for yourself. You're giving yourself that peace of mind to know you're taking care of things. You're not just putting it off, or, you know, it's really you're taking charge and you're taking responsibility and saying, you know what, I want to handle this. You know, this is one of the most important. This may be the final aspect of my life. I want it to be how I want it to be, and hopefully make it enjoyable, or not necessarily enjoyable, but as easy a transition as possible for everyone.
All right. Trevor, thank you so much for calling in. So we're talking about palliative care, and there's approaches and counseling, and we're talking to a family service counselor at a funeral home. Trevor, how well prepared are they to be dealing with all of this? It's a job for them, but are they at the level that, say, you guys are? So Dr. Martha Atkins, you're a death educator. How do you...
There are all kinds of people who talk about this in their own way, and I can't say who's better, who's not better. You're attracted to people who are able to meet you where you are and answer your questions, and if you don't get your questions answered, you go find somebody else who can. So if that resonates with you to go to a funeral home and talk to somebody about end-of-life plans or end-of-life care, go do that. If you'd rather talk to somebody like Dr. Sanchez, who teaches physicians, who has had private practice, those kinds of things, that's a whole other thing. I work with dying people every day. It's a different way than she does. They're all different ways.
So funeral homes are doing what they're doing, and sure, they do the best they can, but you guys are entering into the conversation much earlier with people who are talking about probably getting accustomed to the idea that they are winding down this journey that they're on, and they're dealing with chronic disease, and they can see, you know, how things are concluding, and they have things they want to talk about, and they need professionals at that time. So Dr. Sanchez-Riley, how does that work?
I would actually prefer that they start the conversation early when they are well, able to talk about it, and able to plan and say, okay, what is the most important thing in my life? Is it my quality of life? If I'm able to communicate with my loved ones, how do I want to spend the last days of my life? Do I want to be in machines, or do I want to be surrounded by my family? What is important to me? You are able to talk about that much easier or in a broader perspective if you are well, or if you are just diagnosed with a chronic illness but you're still not, you know, actively dying or confused. I think it's important to start the conversation very early. Not early, very early.
And talking about it doesn't mean it's going to happen. It means you're prepared. And I think people get frightened that if I open this can, it's gonna mean I'm going to go faster. That's not the case. To open it and talk about it and let it be part of your experience of living. It's part of the wholeness of living.
Another caller. This is Tracy. Hi, Tracy. Welcome to The Source. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Thanks, David. I am with the Texas and New Mexico Hospice Organization.
Yay!
And we want to salute TPR and also Dr. Adkins and Dr. Sanchez-Riley for bringing this topic to the forefront here in the San Antonio area. And I've made so many notes listening, and I just want to echo what Dr. Sanchez-Riley said. Start this conversation when you are well. Mm-hmm. Such an important point, and so I appreciate her sharing that. Mm-hmm. Earlier in the program, David, y'all talked about resources that are out there and available for the public to help get this conversation going. Dr. Adkins mentioned the Conversation Project, which is a solid resource. I also want to let listeners know that TNMHO, the Texas New Mexico Hospice Organization, also has a resources page for the public. There are videos that talk about hospice care versus palliative care. There are links to a checklist for planning, links to these advanced directives that you can download and fill in. So I want to let you know those resources are out there, but also just to say thank you. This isn't an easy thing to talk about, but honestly, the longer you put it off, it doesn't make it any easier, really. So,
all right, Tracy, thank you for the call. So she's with the hospice organization. What exactly is a hospice, Dr. Sanchez-Riley?
Thank you for that question, and thank you, Tracy, for bringing that up. I'm going to explain what is palliative care and what is hospice, because I think people tend to confuse them or think they're different things, that they're the same thing, but they are actually very different. So palliative care is actually a medical specialty, and it pertains to people who have chronic illnesses and symptoms. So anybody who has an illness which is non-curable needs to be referred to palliative care. Hospice is a smaller part of palliative care. It's really a benefit that allows patients who are terminally ill, typically in the last 6 months of their life, to experience special care provided by nurses, doctors, and other interdisciplinary team members, and is more geared, again, towards the end of life. But for palliative care, you don't have to be terminally ill to be referred to this medical specialty, which is like any other, cardiology, nephrology, you name it, is one specialty, and this profession are trained to make sure that the patients are very comfortable, and part of their intervention is to actually have conversations.
But now there is a non-medical home for the dying. Mm-hmm. Dr. Martha Adkins, can you tell us about that some?
So the thing about hospice is it's a philosophy of care. It's a way to be cared for. It's not a place. And there is a Medicare benefit. There's Medicaid. People can get hospice as part of that benefit, part of those benefits, but they don't get a place to live. That's not paid for. That's not guaranteed. I know. Look at your brow.
I'm trying to figure that out.
So if you're 65, 70 years old, well, let me give you another one. If you're 90 and your 90-year-old spouse has died and you're by yourself and you need somebody to care for you and you don't have the means to stay at home anymore and you don't have the means to pay for a place to live, somebody's going to take you in, or you're going to end up somewhere. But hospice doesn't pay for a place for you to stay. So there are these non-medical homes that have started to come up around the country. There are just part of the Omega Home Network. There are 26 open homes, and there's another 30 in process that are opening in different parts of the country. They're supported by the community. There's typically a small staff that are non-medical staff and volunteers from the community that help people die well. They give them a place to live, and they serve as family. They work with the hospices. So the hospices at Abode, we don't take anybody who's not on hospice. We've worked with most of the hospices in town. Somebody comes to our place, and we do the day-to-day care and nurturing and loving of them. We don't take blood pressures. We don't take pulses. They've got a fever. We make them as comfortable as we can. We don't take their temperature. It's not that. We're not the medical part of the dying part of the dying process. We're the spiritual part. We live them out. And these homes are cropping up around the country in response, I think, to this need that is growing. Our wait list is typically 25 or 30 deep for people that want to come and be at Abode.
And you think that's because we're doing a great job of keeping people alive longer, but we're not really good at knowing what to do with people who are alive longer?
That's a complex question.
It is. It really is. We live in a country with very complicated medical care. and very complicated care for people who are over 65. And we are moving into a situation in the next 10 or 15 years where 10,000 baby boomers a day are turning 65, and we're not ready. We are not ready to care for all the people who are going to be sick and dying in the next 15 or 20 years. We're just not.
I'm going to go to caller really quick. This is Rachel. Rachel, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for addressing this topic. I just want to say I think the medical community very much underserves the patients and families. I was legal guardian of both my parents. I was so blessed that when I got my dad into the Kerrville Veterans Hospital, that the director was board certified in palliative care, Dr. Michael Martin. He initiated the conversation and said, you know, your dad is in the final stages of Alzheimer's, according to my experience. And no one else had recognized that. And that just helped so much that he was always initiating planning for the next step. With my mother, who had Parkinson's, I asked over and over all the medical people that had all this support, and I would say, isn't it time for her to transition to hospice? I want her to have that support. We know she's not going to get better. And I was told repeatedly no, because her insurance is still paying for her therapy. And I finally just decided I'm going to transition her anyhow, because I wanted her to have that chaplain service and the other things. And then she died less than 2 weeks later, so she did get some benefit. But I feel like the medical community just does not serve the patients and the family members in this. If they're just so focused on money. And I told them, I don't care. If I have to pay for it, if whatever we have to do, I have to take out a loan, it's my mom's death. Who cares whether her insurance is paying for it ultimately? This is her final days on earth.
Okay, Rachel, thank you so much for calling in and raising those concerns. So Dr. Sanchez Riley, can you talk about, it's kind of spotty on who you interact with in the medical community, what kind of response you're going to get?
Unfortunately, yes. First of all, thank you so much for your comment, the listener's comment, because I have to say that the VA is at the forefront of the development of palliative care and hospice and bringing, you know, conversations early. So many of the providers are very in tune to these needs because the VA is a pioneer of these programs. But also, yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, not all medical students receive end-of-life training, and so this is not their priority. And so when they start practicing medicine, they focus more on the procedure that have to be done, you know, and the cure and the different medical new innovations. And they forget about the fact that patients will be dying, that patients will be very sick. And so it's really difficult for the patients and their families to expect that the physician will be bringing this up by herself or himself. The families need to be encouraged to be proactive and saying, we need to talk about this. Please, doctor, help me understand. And they should be able to. So encourage your listeners to be proactive will be very important.
And Dr. Martha Atkins?
Yeah, I'm thinking about Rachel being an advocate for her parents. That's what we have to do. Our medical professionals know what they know, and we know the people we love. And if we have these end-of-life conversations early about what we want, how we want to be cared for, and talk to our advocates about that, talk about it often so people really have a sense of that. When you get in these really high-stress situations and you need help, you go back to those conversations and you gather up your strength and have these conversations with these physicians and
I also feel bad for the physicians who haven't had that training. Now they're finding themselves in these situations, and they must be put through the ringer themselves. Yeah. They need counseling as well and help. All right, we're taking a break here. What kind of questions or comments do you have, a story you want to share about end-of-life planning? Have you thought about where and how you want to die? Death shouldn't be a taboo subject. It happens to everyone. What has your experience been helping a family member prepare for the end of life? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. Let's share these stories. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about end-of-life care. With us in the studio, Dr. Martha Atkins. She's a death educator and professional counselor, executive director of the Abode contemplative
you got it.
Home for the Dying, author of the book Signpost of Dying, and also Dr. Sandra Sanchez Riley. She's Associate Professor of Geriatrics and Palliative Care at UT Health San Antonio. And our phone line is 210-614-8980. And let's get Michelle on the air. Hi, Michelle. Thank you so much for calling in. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I work with Christus Hospice here in San Antonio, and I am so glad that you guys are having this topic discussed today. I've been working with so many of these patients and families over the years, and all of the challenges that y'all are discussing, they are real, and we really need to do more to bring education to the forefront. So I just really thank you so much for having this topic on your show today.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for your support and what you do as a hospice worker. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about DNRs, do not resuscitate. When people talk about these things, I mean, sometimes you're having a conversation over the kitchen table and someone says, well, if I buy it and they hook me up to a machine, unplug the machine. I don't want to be on a machine. Does that count as a DNR? What do I need to have to be have a do not resuscitate?
That's a very good question. So first of all, if you are in the hospital, DNR, do not resuscitate, is a doctor's order. And these orders enter after having a conversation with the patient. And then you will ask, okay, if you are terminally ill and your heart stops beating, because we need to understand do not resuscitate means just cardiopulmonary, heart and lungs. So if your heart stops beating and you're not breathing, that's when you will allow to be will be allowed to die naturally. And so if you're in the hospital, that's just kind of an order. If you are outside the hospital, there's a document called out-of-hospital DNR. It's a form that basically you will fill out and sign, and you will have available. So if something was to happen to you and your heart stops beating and somebody calls 911, they will stop resuscitation. Now, if you are on the kitchen table going back to your situation and said, you know, I don't want to be resuscitated, and then when that person, you know, goes to the hospital and is very sick and unable to communicate, then, you know, their loved one that was with them can say, you know, we had this conversation 2 months ago. We were at the kitchen table. He said, you know, I don't want to be resuscitated. And that will be enough ground for the attending physician to say at that time, okay, these will be very valid and we will not proceed with resuscitation.
But then what happens when Cousin Elroy shows up and he mm-hmm. says, well, you can't do that because they come up with some other reasoning. Mm-hmm. And so things get kind of confusing, and then family members start throwing things at each other. How do you avoid that? I mean, it's, I guess, being clear and precise and getting what you want in writing, I guess.
For sure, writing helps, and be clear and precise and having the conversations early will definitely add to this benefit. But there are many situations in which you have complicated family dynamics, and Cousin Roy shows up, usually from Dallas, you know. and so that
hadn't been around for years, but he shows up and he thinks he knows
that's
everything.
That's right. He knows everything. And so in that case, the Texas law is very clear. We have designated surrogates, what we call it. And so, first of all, it would be ideal if you could designate a medical power of attorney to be able to make your wishes known. And that is a document that is signed when the patient is well, able to make his or her decisions. And so if you designate a medical power of attorney, that person will be your voice. But if you don't have a medical power of attorney, then you go into the surrogates. And the Texas law says, well, your surrogate is your actively involved spouse. And if you don't have a spouse, you go to the children.
It can be like same-sex spouse, same gender.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And then if you don't have a spouse, then you go to the children. So they have to be adult or emancipated children. And if you have 9 children, all of them will get to decide. So it gets very tricky when you don't have a medical power of attorney, as you can see, you know, because then they'll have to have consensus. It's not the eldest, not the one that loves you the most, is consensus. Good luck, man. Consensus in this type of situation. Mm-hmm. After that go the parents, you know, and there is a whole hierarchy of things that that the law is very clear about.
And do you want to add to that, Dr. Martha Atkins?
That was fabulous.
All right, so let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Mike. Hey, Mike, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd say I'm a general surgery resident physician. I'm in my fourth year, so I'm relatively young in my practice compared to your guests. But I would just remind everyone that it's so important for everybody to have this conversation with their family and indeed get everything in writing, because I've taken care of a number of young patients who've been in traumatic accidents mm-hmm. and couldn't communicate. And it comes because elderly patients were used.
All right, Mike, so we started losing you, but I think we caught the idea what you're telling us about. This isn't just something that people who are at end of life, we can eyeball them and tell you're at end of life. All of us are at end of life, really. We never know. You know, there's the Irish saying, live every day like it's your last, because one of these days you'll be right. And so we have to think about that. And also you want to have these conversations when you're of sound mind and body mm-hmm. so that you're not making decisions, you know, in the frantic moment. Mm-hmm. So how do you approach that, Dr. Martha Atkins?
So there's a really great resource called Death Over Dinner, and you can find it on the internet, and there are questions if you're going to have this conversation with your family, you're going to have it with your friends, you're going to have it with whomever, and it takes you on a little algorithm, and then it gives you something to listen to, something to watch, and I don't remember.
And a sort of questions.
Yeah.
That you can have a conversation.
So then you have questions at this dinner, and you spend 3 or 4 hours talking with people about this very thing in a non-threatening environment with people who are interested in the same topic. And I think that is a really fantastic way to broach the conversation.
And what age should someone have all this nailed down? Dr. Atkins?
I think when you can have the conversation, I know Dr. Jennifer Zeters is talking with high school kids about this, which I think is wonderful. And if that can start that early about what organ donation is, and have you ever thought about dying, and have you ever thought about grieving, things that are normal, natural part of the human experience. Again, doesn't mean it's going to happen, but let's start talking about it and let it be fodder for conversation.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing up organ donation.
Yeah.
So how do we make sure that if a person has the intent, because that's just the most precious commodity that we have as a society, we don't have enough kidneys and livers and things mm-hmm. that can be used to help people out. How do you make sure that if you want to be an organ donor, that that's going to be part of this as well? So Dr. Sandra Sanchez-Riley?
I mean,
if you put that in your DNA. Write it down.
It can definitely be part of your writing a statement about your wishes. And of course, you know, your driver's license will be the first part to have that.
Well, I've heard that that's not enough. Sometimes they can say they ignore your driver's license.
That and your significant other's consent will be enough for organ donation. So having the conversation with your loved one will be important, so that person is able to respect your wishes if that horrible moment comes.
Right, and so that your moment could also be a benefit to some
for
people
sure.
who really need
for
that.
Sure.
Let's go to another caller. This is Rose. Hi, Rose. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
And Rose, you there?
I've been listening.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Rose.
My dad passed away last year at 95, and I was the only kid who moved back to San Antonio. And about 8 years ago, he made me visit all the funeral homes with him, just starting to get things ready.
Good for him.
And he wouldn't go to a doctor unless he absolutely needed it. He was really strong and healthy. But there was a generational difference because his perspective was doctors always pushing you into things and like to experiment because they're trying to learn, and he wasn't willing to give up his life like that. So he had a sense of humor, but he did have the wherewithal to go ahead and start making those plans. So we went to funeral homes first. Then he had a fall, and we ended up in the hospital. And it wasn't until then that I was introduced to palliative care. But it was done in such a rude way. I had to confront a doctor. And I believe it was because my dad was on Medicaid that the attitude was that way. But it was just so surprising. But it was good to get the information, but it was just the way it was delivered offended my dad and me. But so we got him into palliative care, and then we eventually got him into hospice. But he did all of that with a clear mind.
Mm-hmm. All right, Rose, thank you so much. Can I get your reaction to that, Dr. Sanchez-Riley?
Well, Rose, I am so sorry that your experience at the beginning was a difficult one. So let me apologize on behalf of the medical community, but I am so glad that your dad had the care that he needed at the end of his life, and that he did it with a clear mind, and that he was able to choose, because that's what we want. We want our patients to be empowered and be able to choose the type of care that they wanted at the end of their lives.
All right, so Rose tells a story about her dad and how, although it wasn't as smooth as she would have liked, eventually she did find some help and was able to make things. So I think that it makes it easier when you are the survivor loved one to know that at the end he died with a clear mind. And that's an incredible gift that you can give to your loved ones if you plan this all out, you know, in a good way. Dr. Martha Atkins, mm-hmm. Your reaction?
Yeah, again, that she was an advocate for him, and I wonder about the people who show up in these situations who don't have an advocate and where they end up in the systems, and it's difficult. And I'm glad she was able to do that for him, and I'm sorry for the difficult parts. They happen. We're human. Doctors are human, and we do the best we can.
And everyone is stressed out in these situations. You're not catching people at their best, frequently catching them at their worst, because golly, what a
And we need good care.
Yeah. All right, we're taking a break. We're going to talk about medical power of attorney a little bit more, how to set that up, creating a living will and communicating advanced care directives to your loved ones, how that looks, what that looks like. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about end-of-life care, how to prepare for that big final goodbye, how to deal with it. It's never going to be easy, but planning for it could make it easier. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Jim is on the line. And Jim, hi. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
You're welcome. My wife was 68. 4 years ago, she passed away from a brain aneurysm. She was gone from the moment she hit the bed. No chance to say goodbye, I love you, anything. A friend of mine whose husband died 6 months before my wife spent 5 years going downhill with cancer, died at home. What's the better way for your loved ones to go?
Oh, boy, that's a tough question, Jim. I'm really sorry to hear about the loss of your wife. So first off, Dr. Martha Atkins, there is no good way.
We're all going to die. And the sudden death is very different than a long-term illness, non-treatable, non-curable. There's, as you said, the opportunity to say goodbye. That can be a really long goodbye for somebody who's sick, and a different kind of goodbye when somebody, has an aneurysm. It's, I think it's apples and oranges. They're both 100% painful, and you make meaning of them the best way you can. I can't say that there's a better way.
And Dr. Sandra Sanchez Riley, it is what it is. You know, you can't try to spin it that one way is better than the other. This is what you got.
Yeah, there's not a right way of doing this, and not the best way of doing this. It's just what happens. And so thank you, Jim, for your story. The grieving process will happen either if you have 5 years to take care of your loved one or if your loved one unfortunately dies suddenly. I will say the message is be prepared as if you were going to die tomorrow. But treasure all the memories and the moments that you have with your loved ones and know that everybody is grieving no matter how long or painful the process would have been.
But the sudden death does kind of, if you don't have the living will or advanced care directives or haven't had these conversations in advance, that really can make it all the more difficult. It doesn't have to be that way because you can have these conversations now. So talk about what do people need to line up, having a living will. How do I prepare that? How do I communicate advanced care directives? How do I get there? So Dr. Sandra Sanchez Riley.
Yes. So the The process that in which we prepare for end-of-life care is called advanced care planning. And the documents that we use to prepare for that process will include the documents you were mentioning. So living will refers specifically to your medical care. There is a type of will that refers to your property, but the one that you want to prepare for sure for this type of care is the living will. And it will allow you to say, if you were in a situation in which you were extremely sick and you really did not have a way of getting better, how would you like your care to proceed, basically. And then the other document that is part of this cadre of documents will be the medical power of attorney, in which you designate somebody to be your voice. So if you were unable to communicate your wishes, that person will become your voice. So those are kind of the two main documents. In Texas, you could actually find them all over the website, but one specific website that I wanted to recommend is the Texas Hospital Association website. It has the documentation, and it really, all you require is a witness. It doesn't really need to be notarized. You have to be of sound mind, capable of making your decisions, and having a witness to sign that. And of course, communicating the wishes that you just signed to your loved ones, so they honor them.
There's also, it may seem simple, but it can be difficult, the passwords that people have for their accounts.
Yeah.
If you don't share them and you have a sudden death and you're trying to help that person bring their affairs into order, if you don't have those passwords, that can be really difficult. Should we share those things, prepare those things? How do you deal with that, Dr. Martin?
There are apps you can get that help you organize all those things, and you can give.
But you have to think about it.
You do have to think about it. Yeah. But people have, and they have created ways for that to be easier for you and your family. So, yeah, have a look around for those.
And share those passwords.
Yeah.
All right. Another caller. This is Allison. Hi, Allison. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to kind of reinforce and advocate for younger people thinking about this as well. My brother's wife passed away in her sleep suddenly at 34, and it was surprising to me. It was the first death that I dealt with directly, and it was really surprising to me how much you have to get done in a really short period of time. It was really intense, and I think if she had had a plan, it would have really helped the family and my brother be able to grieve a little more and not necessarily have to like try to figure everything out. So again, just, you know, if you're a younger person, you never know what's going to happen, like you guys said already. And it's really important to think about that too.
Allison, thank you for the call. I'm going to go to another caller because we have a bunch of them here. Chris, hi, Chris. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Would that be me?
Yes, sir.
All right. My name is Chris. I have service dogs and therapy. I have a service dog, and I also have therapy dogs. And I take them to nursing homes here in San Antonio. I tried hospice care one time, but it was really, really hard on me, not mm-hmm. knowing whether the person that I was visiting was going to be there the following week mm-hmm. and to watch people be in pain.
Yeah.
And so are you trying to talk about the difficulty in being a caregiver for the situation? We need to have...
I really think so. I think caregivers are incredibly underrated for the folks that are there. I've got a neighbor that's nursing her her mom who's had a stroke, and she's a real neat lady. The daughters take turns, one a week every three daughters rotating. So, and they're 24/7 with their mom. Mm-hmm. And I've even had to go over and help pick her up in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm. Chris, thank you so much. And as we have the aging population, there's going to be more demand for caregivers here in America, and they're going to be in short supply. What's some ways we can think about caring for caregivers, Dr. Sandra Sanchez-Riley?
I mean, first of all, salute them, encourage them, make them feel loved and welcome, because what they do is amazing. As Chris was saying, it is definitely a life-changing experience. I mean, caregivers sometimes they lose their jobs, their independence, their life. They even put their health at peril because they are so wrapped up in the care of their loved one. So there are caregiver programs that we have in the community that train the caregivers to take care of themselves, that to take care of their loved ones. And also there are resources available to have volunteer, for example, help them so they can run an errand while they come. Hospice care actually provides volunteers and provides some resources to allow the caregivers to have some time for themselves.
Now another caller, this is Robin. Hi, Robin. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, I just want to address the issue that in addition to caring for the patient, hospice is an invaluable tool to utilize as far as respite care for the loved ones during the process and also after the process to help with healing and grief.
Okay, Robin, thank you for that. And is that really the role of hospice? Are they really well-equipped to become a facility to help people deal with the grief, Dr. Martha Atkins?
That's part of the benefit and part of the requirement from Medicare is that hospice provides grief counseling. So every hospice has a bereavement coordinator, and those bereavement coordinators follow up with the family members after the person has died. That's one of the benefits and a good one.
And so people should know about that, and if it's not offered, they should be asking about that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
This is a resource that everyone should take advantage
yes,
of.
Yes, absolutely.
And even if they didn't have the advantage of having their loved one in hospice, they can contact hospice agencies, and they will provide bereavement counseling as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've been talking about how important these issues are, and we've kind of walked people through what they can be doing, but still it's very difficult to know how to engage with these services. What's the best way, the first step that people can be taking in order to make sure that they're able to get on the right path and move forward with that? So, Dr. Sandra Sanchez-Riley.
I will say the first thing is start the conversation. Just start it in your family. See how far along do you get. And you may be surprised to hear that actually your loved ones want to talk about it. Second, I will say ask your doctor. If you have a doctor and access to healthcare, ask your doctor and be proactive in saying, okay, I want to plan my end-of-life care. Third, get resources in the community such as the Dead Cafe or the Dead Over Dinner. Go to a movie, get informed. That would be my recommendation.
You know, we had the opportunity to go work with a bunch of folks at a church recently, and they're really interested in end-of-life care, and they're interested in being a community for people in their church who are going to need that kind of help. And that, to me, feels like a really important thing to do and to do more of. We need community. We're often on our phones and doing the things that we do these days, and being together, being in neighborhoods, being with your religious community, your spiritual community, and connecting in ways that are heart connections will help you when you get to a place where something happens in life that's really difficult to manage. The community we have at Abode has grown and grown and grown, and besides taking care of the guests and families, we take care of each other, and it's a really beautiful thing.
I'm blown away by the response from the callers and everything you're saying. This is something that San Antonio has a lot of resources available, a lot of compassion here for people in this situation, and hopefully people were able to engage with that. I want to thank both of our guests, Dr. Martha Atkins. She's a death educator, professional counselor. She wrote the book Signpost of Dying, and Dr. Sandra Sanchez-Riley, associate professor of geriatrics and palliative care at UT Health San Antonio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.